From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. I'm here from San Francisco, filling in while Terry Gross is on vacation. Believe you me, it's well-deserved. Over the past few decades, scientists have researched and described the mechanisms of our five senses. Writers and poets struggle to describe the experience of our senses. So for her natural history of the senses, writer Diane Ackerman draws on both science and art. Also, filmmaker Christian Blackwood checks us into some motels where a good night's sleep is incidental to the stay. Rock critic Ken Tucker checks out dancehall reggae, and film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews the new David Lynch film, Wild at Heart. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. President Bush said this afternoon he feels any differences that exist between the U.S. and Jordan were narrowed during his meeting today with Jordan's King Hussein. Speaking with reporters at his vacation home in Maine, the president said he's very pleased that King Hussein restated his country's support for the United Nations sanctions against Iraq. Mr. Bush also said U.N. sanctions appear to be taking hold against Iraq. The president said it's very positive that there doesn't seem to be any oil coming out of that country. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein lashed out at President Bush today in a speech read out on Iraqi radio. Saddam called the U.S. president a liar and warned that thousands of Americans will return home in coffins if there's a military confrontation. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Dubai.
The war of words was touched off yesterday when President George Bush called Saddam a liar and accused Iraqi troops of plundering Kuwait. Saddam responded in kind. He called on President Bush to tell the American people that their troops are not welcome in Arab and Islamic public opinion. Whoever lies loses his power to influence, said the Iraqi leader. While the speech was billed as a direct message to the American president, it was a bitter personal attack. The Iraqi leader repeated his intention to hold on to Kuwait following the August 2nd invasion. Earlier in the day, Iraqi officials warned that foreign pilots could not expect mercy if they were shot down over Iraqi territory. In Dubai, this is Deborah Amos.
The U.S. today again refused to rule out the use of chemical weapons in the Middle East in response to a chemical attack by Iraq. The U.S. delegate to the 40-nation Geneva Conference on Disarmament said that if attacked with chemical weapons, the U.S. needs to have a variety of response options. The U.S. and other countries pledged in an international pact during the 1970s not to be the first to use chemical weapons. Lloyd's Shipping Intelligence in London says that Jordanian port authorities have forced a cargo ship to break sanctions against Iraq. NPR's Jackie Lydon has details.
According to Lloyd's and the Reuters news agency in Cyprus, Jordanian port authorities in Aqaba forced the Cypriot freighter Amr Ved to unload 1,000 tons of sugar for Iraq. The ship's managers told Reuters that the cargo left Rouen, France, on July 23rd with sugar to be delivered to Jordanian agents for Iraq. Because of the sanctions, the ship was advised by its owners not to proceed to Aqaba, but was already in Jordanian waters. Jordan has not yet closed Aqaba, though it has said it will comply with the sanctions. It has 30 days, it says, to seek clarification on just what's allowed. King Hussein discussed Aqaba with President Bush today. The president has threatened to shut off the Aqaba port if it allows Iraq a backdoor route to goods. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed sharply lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 67 points to 2681.44. Declines swamped advances by a margin of 4-1.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. I'd like you to take a deep breath. Go ahead. Smell whatever it is that's in the air. Dinner cooking, the office air conditioning, that cup of coffee in front of you, the diesel fumes from the car ahead of you, or even the person next to you. Go ahead. Take a whiff. I'll wait. Okay, that odor is now registered on a small yellowish patch high in your nostril. Later, try to describe that smell to someone else who's never smelled what you just did. We'll reach for words, metaphors. We'll say it smells like, we even do the same to describe taste. Well, it tastes a little like chicken. Describing how our senses work and how our senses work us is Diane Ackerman's quest in her book, The Natural History of the Senses. She's a poet who also writes for The New Yorker about nature. Her other writings describe learning to fly and the beauties of the solar system. One of the challenges for naturalists who write is to convey their vivid experience across a page to the reader. I asked Diane Ackerman how she tried to describe smells for her natural history.
It's very difficult to describe smells. That's been one of the greatest challenges to literary writers. And we have lots of visual words with which we describe what we see, but we don't have precise words for many of the smells that we take for granted. It would be lovely if we had a word for the smell of a top of an infant's head, for instance, which smells so talky and untampered with by life. We don't have that. I know from my experience as a nature writer that there are various smells like penguin smells that are profoundly and undilutedly penguin, but we don't really have a word that we assign to it.
Well, in part to call it penguininity or something like that, I mean, means that other people would have to know what penguins smell
they
like
would,
as
that's
well.
That's true. They would have to know that. Or you could say something like penguinine, which sounds like a mountain range. Or you could say pinguid, which means kind of fatty, which wouldn't be correct either. Somehow we just haven't been relaxed enough and jubilant enough to want to go out and make a wonderful map of the smells of the world. We don't even really have a casual word for what happens when people lose their sense of smell. We have a formal word. We say that somebody without a sense of smell is suffering from anosmia. But we don't say that that person is something like smum. We should have a word for it that would normalize them more so that they wouldn't feel so freakish.
Well, then there are words that replicate themselves through the senses, like apricot is both a color and a taste. It's also a smell and also a sight.
Yes, that's true. And, of course, people who are willing synesthetes, that is, people who look at a color and think of a smell and manage to get their senses to do double and triple and quadruple and quintuple duty for one another, very often use a word like apricot when they hear a sound. So there are ways to make some of the sensory words double up in a pinch.
What is the term for people who have who mix the senses, who combine them?
This is a synesthesia. The people who do it are synesthetes. Some people are willing synesthetes. An awful lot of artists have been, especially composers. Very often composers have said that they would hear a note and think of a color. And the curious thing is that the colors that the composers associated with notes tended to be very similar. So it just seems like there are certain parts of the brain in which the wiring is a tiny bit cozier in some people than it is in others.
Is this something further down the evolutionary line or earlier in human history?
My guess is that it's earlier. Newborn babies always are confusing such things as smells and sights. They really haven't progressed to that categorical, analytical wonderland in which we tend to live as adults, and everything is a beautiful Niagara of smell and song and sky and mother.
My guest is Diane Ackerman. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and has written several books of poetry. She has a new best-selling book called A Natural History of the Senses. As a poet, you like to work with words. They're your tools, and you certainly have lots of words to work with in describing the senses. But some of your work has also included writings on flying, teaching yourself to fly. And you seem to revel in the jargon, the nomenclature of activities.
I guess I do. It's wonderful that you could use something as intrinsically neutral as a word and have that word conjure up a complete arena of emotion and circumstance. Let me give you an example. You mentioned flying. Yes, I wrote a book called On Extended Wings about flying and what that teaches you about the world. One day I was learning to fly, and I was flying over Richmond, Virginia. When you leave an airport, you have to address an air traffic controller whose name is Departure. And you say, Departure, I am with you. And when I said that, my eyes suddenly teared up because I realized that in a much more profound and elaborate sense, Departure is always with us. Death is always with us. But it's curious to have to say it in this disembodied way to a voice over the airways, like an Old Testament God speaking to you in your aircraft, someone you will never see by face. It's just jargon to most pilots, of course, but there are a couple of ways to look at such words.
One of the bits of jargon is a navigation mnemonic. True virgins make dull company.
Yes, that has to do with charting your course across the landscape, and most pilots have traditionally been men, and so, of course, there's all kinds of frisky language like that that they use to remember things by.
As a poet or as a pilot, did you ever want to change it?
I don't think so. I'll tell you what I did want to do. There are intersections in the sky that have five letters to each intersection, so there could be Heidi as an intersection. And I thought it would be fun to go across the country renaming them so that they would better reflect what was taking place underneath them. All of the ones over Williamsburg, Virginia, would have a colonial theme to them. All of the ones around Cape Canaveral would have an astronomical theme. I just thought that would be an interesting thing to do. I never did get permission to do it, although I have been just a tiny bit involved in naming some craters on Mercury. That was fun.
How did you come to do that?
Well, there is a committee that has to meet and decide what place names will be called on the different planets. If you look at a map of Mars, you will discover the most glorious nomenclature. You can go from candor to chaos in Mars in, oh, I would think a matter of hours. Or you could take a vacation in Pandora or Da Vinci. You can go to fabulous places. Somebody has to decide on those names. And I was asked at one point for the names of some lovers to be craters on Mercury, and I chose some ancient lovers, Genji and Lady Murasaki, so that they could be side by side forever.
You quote A.E. Hausman in your book as describing poetry as a human secretion. how do you view poetry?
Oh, I think that poetry is a form of inquiry. It's a way to get out and roam around the world and be a nomad and pick up your tent one day and pitch it someplace else the next day. Try to figure out all the to-ings and fro-ings of life.
The language of senses seems to revolve around one end, really, survival, either helping us to flee or to fight, or for reproduction, images, senses of to encourage sexuality and reproduction.
That is the origin, really, of all of the senses, to help us continue breeding or to protect us. So, for example, something tastes sour to us because it would be poisonous, it would be dangerous for us to eat it or to drink it. On the other hand, even though evolution has greatly guided us and probably controls us in many complicated and subtle ways that we're not aware of, we do manage now and then to sidestep evolution just for sport. So even though coffee signals a newborn baby that something is dangerous because it tastes sour, we like to drink it just as an extra novelty, or we like to eat things that are very hotly spiced. We don't always pay attention to evolution. Sometimes I think we like to stray from it just for athletic purposes. Probably the best example of that would be the fashion for eating fugu, the flesh of the puffer fish.
This is a deadly fish, isn't it?
This is a deadly fish. Its flesh contains a kind of poison that has been used in voodoo zombification ceremonies. It's very dangerous stuff. And it's considered a very high art form in Japan, the preparation of fugu, and the actual ritual of dining on the fugu. And the best fugu chefs are the ones who manage to leave in just enough of the poison that the diner's lips will tingle with the close call to that person's mortality, but the diner won't actually die.
In your research for the book, have you sampled fugu?
No, I decided not to do that. I did lots of other research things, but I thought that would be a little reckless. I passed on that. A curious thing about fugu is that it's understood that people can seem to die of fugu poisoning, but really just go into a state of paralysis and not wake up for days. People who have done that and woken up later who weren't buried reported appearing to be dead, but being fully aware of all of the proceedings of the funeral, and desperately wishing that someone would realize they were still alive. And therefore, in Japan, if someone dies of fugu poisoning, it is legal for that person not to be buried for a few days just in case they're going to wake up.
I want to ask about the sense of smell. How specific our sense of smell can be. For instance, perfume smellers, people who develop perfume, end up working with complex and very small amounts of scent in order to create a larger scent. How sensitive is our nose to these gradations of odor?
Our nose is very, very sensitive, but of course that depends on the person, and the sensitivity is hereditary. There is a little patch in the back of everyone's nose, which tends to be yellowish in color. If it is very deeply yellow, then you will have a much stronger sense of smell than if it happens to be very pale. So albinos tend to have a very poor sense of smell, and some people have a very robust and rich sense of smell. But having said that, of course, you can train your sense of smell in the same way that you can train any of your other senses, just by focusing on them enough, really concentrating. So someone who is a nose by profession probably has a nice genetic makeup that allows her to become a great nose, and then probably becomes a better and better nose over the years the more she does it. I talked with a woman like that in New York when I was working on the book. This is a lovely, earthy Russian woman who invents most of the famous perfumes in the world.
The ones that sell for hundreds of dollars in department stores?
Oh, yes. The mm-hmm. ones whose names would be known in any household. She is a kind of ghostwriter. She's not allowed to tell you which perfumes she invents, but she invents most of them. She has an exquisitely sensitive nose, and she has in her offices what looks like an organ on which you would play music, but it contains a symphony of smells. And she mixes them. She knows what each one is in the same way that a composer would understand what sounds would be made by the brasses or the timpani. And she mixes them up depending on what she would like.
Some of the raw ingredients of perfume are sensed from anal glands of different animals and from the guts of other creatures.
Yes.
How do you think humans first came to discover how these fragrances could work on us?
I think that's really quite a question. I mean, who was the first person who wanted to reach into the anal sac of a civet? I don't know. And having done that, who was the first person who said, I think that would make a nice perfume?
Yeah, and then rub it on yourself.
Let's rub it all over ourselves and see if we like each other better. I don't know who first invented that, but there's no doubt that such pure animal smells, if taken straight, are very repulsive and probably would make you throw up. But when just a little bit of them is added to other ingredients, we find them deeply aphrodisiac. Part of the reason is that a number of these smells are similar enough, the chemicals are similar enough to human pheromones, that they're reminiscent to us, and so we have a response. Male pig hormone is very similar to male human hormone. And so it's an ingredient in some best-selling perfumes.
Are the odors that go into perfumes the same kind of odors that would have the same effect on people all over the world, or are certain odors culture-specific?
I think the answer to that is yes and no. There are some givens with all of the senses. There are some givens in terms of music and musical response, smell, taste, all those things. But then having said that, there also are cultural preferences. If you've grown up surrounded by the smells of curry being prepared, you're probably going to love it for the rest of your life because smell is a very emotional sense. The other senses are interpreted in different parts of the brain, but smell is interpreted in the oldest part of the brain, the seat of our emotions, and therefore it's a deeply emotional sense. Nothing is more memorable than a smell. You smell something, let's say lemon, and suddenly you can be transported across time and country back perhaps 20 years to your grandmother's house where maybe she used a lemon-scented floor polish or she used to bake lemon cookies. Without a moment's hesitation, you will just be flung out of yourself and suddenly remember everything from that time.
What's the earliest memory you have of a smell?
Oh, I don't know about a smell memory, that would be hard to say. I think when I was growing up in the Midwest and there was a plum orchard that I walked through on the way to school each day, I remember looking up, this was one of my first visual memories too, and I saw that the plums, which were dark and rich and purple, were huddled like little bats in the trees above me, and I remember the odor, the fragrance of them.
My guest is writer Diane Ackerman. Her new book is A Natural History of the Senses. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is New Yorker staff writer Diane Ackerman. How does taste tie in with cravings? Say a craving for chocolate. Is this a taste, a biological need for some substance in the food?
Chocolate passion is a very controversial subject right now. It fascinates me in particular because I am a dyed-in-the-wool chocoholic, as many people are. I'm persuaded from reading the research that the reason people crave chocolate is that there is a chemical in chocolate called PEA, which the body normally produces when we fall in love. It gives us an amphetamine-like rush, and we are just riding on a roller coaster. This level of the chemical drops, of course, when we fall out of love or when we've been jilted, and that may very well be why people who are suffering in that way rush home and immediately pig out on chocolate, and also why traditionally sweethearts have given chocolate to one another when they go to see them. People who argue against this say that really what chocoholics are craving is just the carbohydrate or just the sugar in it, something like that. But I think if that were true, then a cookie would do or pasta would do.
Do you have an explanation based on your own personal experience?
Well, I think that chocolate is so specific a craving, as anyone who is lying awake at 11 or 12 at night on a snowy evening saying, boy, would I love some chocolate right now, and just decides to run out to that corner store and get some, knows. It's so specific a craving that I think really it is a chemical one, and I think it's very, very likely that there is this PEA in chocolate, and that's what we're trying to replenish in our bodies when we eat it.
We use our senses in some ways to sort of fuel ourselves for some task. We might want to step outside for a breath of fresh air. We need a certain kind of light that'll help us work a little better under other circumstances. Sometimes we need to eat a food to get us going. What senses do you draw on to start your day as a writer?
Just about every morning in the summer, I go out into my yard where I have raised beds of miscellaneous flowers, and I spend a very serene, zen-like hour or so rejoicing in the colors and the smells and deciding which flowers I'm going to pick on that day. I'm untroubled by anything so awkward as thought, and I find that a lovely way to wake up in the morning.
You consider thought awkward?
If what you're doing is just enjoying the colors and the sights and the sounds of the day as it's dawning. Yes, but I've discovered in researching the book that really each of the senses is wildly important. I didn't realize when I first began working on it how important touch was. However, I went down to an intensive care ward for preemies, premature babies, in Miami as part of the work on this book. And traditionally, preemies are put into little isolation booths so that they won't be tampered with in any way and that they're safe from germs. But what the scientists have been discovering of late is that if you do that with a baby, it mistakenly thinks that it's been abandoned by its mother. And it shouldn't do anything extravagant that would use up its energies, like grow, for instance. And these preemies that are put away like this in these isolation booths tend to have immune system disorders when they're older. They tend not to develop quickly enough. They have all kinds of learning problems. And they can sometimes have emotional and psychological problems. And all of that can be counteracted by having people come in regularly and massage them. It's best if it's the parents. But it can be anyone. There are volunteers, very often middle-aged men, who will come in at all hours of day and night and just regularly touch these babies. It greatly alters the course of their lives.
I'd like to shift topics here for
okay.
a second. You worked once on a cattle ranch in New Mexico. What
yes,
took
it
you
did.
There?
Well, I was in my 20s. I had grown up with a passion for horses and horseback riding, as a lot of American girls do. I had always fantasized about riding out with the cowboys. One day I discovered that I was a writer and a grown-up, and I could probably do this. And so I went out to a 200,000-acre cattle ranch, a working cattle ranch in northeastern New Mexico, and I just signed on. I went there in each of its seasons so that I could herd the cattle and take part in the roping and branding and the calving, which I especially loved. And it was just fascinating to see what kinds of things were still being done on horseback, just as they were being done 100 years ago in the Old West.
A few years ago, you worked as a soccer journalist.
Yes. You know about that, huh?
What attracted you to soccer?
I was starting to write a novel about play. I wanted to learn about ceremonial violence and the history of play. And I thought that would be an interesting way to do it. I tuned into a television show, and I saw soccer taking place, a very lyrical, beautiful game, a lawn game in which men seemed to be hazing quarry towards a net. I thought it was anthropological and lyrical and very beautiful.
We sometimes often wish to heighten our senses, and we use perfumes or salt or drugs to do it, and sometimes we want to neutralize them by either drugs or climbing in sensory deprivation tanks. What is going on when we want to sort of neutralize our senses?
The world presents such a delicious whelm of experience, of sensory experience from moment to moment, that there are times when I suppose we would just like to take a nap. We sleep at night, but for some of us who are keenly aware of the world, that isn't even enough in itself, and so we do things like meditate or want to tune out. But there's no way to tune out entirely. Even if you do that, you attempt to do it, you find that some other sense is taking over. You suddenly become aware of the throbbing of your heart or the rushing of your veins or the ticking of the clock. It's almost impossible to make the senses stop.
The place in which we experience a sense can determine whether it's considered pleasurable or pain that's worthwhile or pain that's torture. You refer to the experience of having your legs waxed. painful, torture, pleasure?
All of that. This is a modern scourging parlor, I think. I went into a very classy place in Manhattan to have my legs waxed. And it occurred to me that all you'd have to do is change the woman who was doing it from a brawny Romanian woman to a Nazi Gestapo, change the place where it was happening, but keep the level of pain identical, and we would consider this torture. We would not consider this something appropriate, not to be whined or winced or screamed about in the cause of beauty.
So what does our mind do to explicate that? What does our mind do to try to shape that pain, to do it? Is it merely our own sort of justification? Is it our own free will that we're undergoing a procedure rather than somebody doing it to us?
I think that we are willing to make peace with all kinds of extremes if we believe that there is no malice, that somebody is not doing it out of any sense of cruelty, but that they actually want to come to our aid in some way.
In your book, you cover five of the known senses. Are there other senses that you feel exist?
I'm sure. It's just by convenience that we refer to five senses, but there are a great many senses that we need to spend a lot of time exploring. And I'm sure that in the coming decades we'll do that more thoroughly.
Well, thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh, Unperfumed Air.
Thank you. The pleasure's been mine.
My guest has been Diane Ackerman. Her new book is A Natural History of the Senses. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, film director Alan Pakula. His latest film is Presumed Innocent, the courtroom thriller based on Scott Turow's best-selling novel, which stars Harrison Ford. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. I know I'll never find another love as sweet as you. You walk into my life and to my grave. This music is a mix of reggae, rap, and hip-hop. It's what's called dancehall reggae. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new dancehall albums. Christian Blackwood's documentaries play to extended runs in Europe, but you rarely come across them here in the U.S. Coming up, we meet Christian Blackwood and we find out what we miss. And this year's winner at the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival has just reached America's shores. Film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews David Lynch's Wild at Heart. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iraqi military officials in Kuwait are said to have ordered all 4,000 Britons there to a hotel. The same order reportedly went out to the 2,500 Americans trapped in the tiny occupied country. The Iraqis said their purpose is to protect Westerners, but the U.S. Embassy lodged an immediate protest. Barry Schweid reports from the State Department.
Ambassador Nathaniel Howell told the Iraqis the order is impractical and unjustified. A senior U.S. official in Washington said the Iraqis told Howell if the Americans did not go to the International Hotel across from the U.S. Embassy, Iraqi forces would go out and find them. While the U.S. objects to the order, it left it up to the Americans to decide on their own what to do. Richard Boucher, a State Department spokesman, said the Americans would be better off in their homes, though. Boucher described the situation in Kuwait as tense, but he said the Americans there were bearing up. Once again, the State Department declined to describe them as hostages. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
Iraqi President Hussein today answered a speech by President Bush made yesterday by calling the U.S. leader a liar and warning that any war with his country could result in thousands of American deaths. The Iraqi leader said that Mr. Bush had not told the truth about American objectives in the Persian Gulf region, and he once again said that Iraq would never pull out of Kuwait. A State Department spokesman said the comments appeared to be another attempt to distort the truth. Temperatures of 110 degrees and more are making life miserable for U.S. troops deployed in Saudi Arabia, but the military says that heat-related casualties have been minimal. More from NPR's John Idsty in Saudi Arabia.
The military feared they would have many heat-related problems in this harsh desert climate, but the byword of U.S. troops here has become keep hydrated, and the soldiers are drinking water by the gallon. The recommended minimum is 6 quarts a day. And as a result, the number of heat-related casualties is much lower than expected, according to military doctors. But there are still a few, like this soldier, who got overheated swinging a sledgehammer, driving in tent pegs.
I was just sitting on a box trying to regain some faculty, and I just felt overheated, hot, kind of dizzy, but not on the point of getting sick.
He was taken to this field hospital in an air-conditioned tent and said he was recovering well. I'm John Idsty with U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia.
According to Pentagon sources, some 45,000 U.S. Marines will be sent to the Persian Gulf area to join the thousands of troops already committed. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 67 points to close at 2,681.44. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, I talk about motels with filmmaker Christian Blackwood. But first, if you think that all reggae sounds, well, like reggae, rock critic Ken Tucker has news for you. These days, some reggae musicians are blending their beat with other contemporary styles. Ken reviews two albums featuring this new sound synthesis, one from Shinehead and one from this duo, Frighty and Colonel Might.
Over the years, I've come to realize that my problem with reggae is that I don't like it straight. I prefer it mixed with something. In its purest state, I find the genre as monochromatic and tediously repetitive as I gather other people used to find disco. But combine its beat with soul music, for example, and you get Toots and the Maytals, whose reggae echo of Otis Redding I've always loved. Or mix it with poetry, and you get Linton Kwesi Johnson. He uses the rhythm as a backbeat for his politically informed poems. The stuff works as both verse and music. Nowadays, there's a new mixture at work in this genre. It's called dancehall reggae. Dancehall reggae is also called combination style because it combines reggae rhythms and crooning with rapping and hip-hop instrumentation. The cut you just heard was Ragamuffin Girl by a duo called Frighty and Colonel Mite. You could hear the way Frighty sings around Colonel Mite's rapping, and the song is powered by an electronic drum machine track rather than the human rhythm section that's usually used in traditional reggae. Dancehall music results in a harder-edged, more intense sound.
In the beginning there was nothing, so he created heaven and earth, and everything therein in turn gave birth. Yeah, last but not least, he made man to rule the land, but man had a different plan. Understand? The snake had a trick up his sleeve, fooled Adam and Eve. I'ma tell you who made them all leave. They tried to pull a fast one, but that was the first and last one, cause they got caught, and guess who wasn't taking no shorts?
That's Shinehead, probably the most talented and inventive of the dancehall reggae performers. Shinehead was born Edmund Carl Aiken in London. He was raised in Jamaica and settled in New York. Shinehead seems to be open to any and all musical styles. One of the most charming tracks on his new disc, The Real Rock, is this version of the Everly Brothers' old hit, Till I Kissed You. Dancehall reggae artists are obsessed with technology in all its various forms. Listen to Shinehead's World of the Video Game, for example. It uses the cheerful little melody that fans of Nintendo computer games will recognize as the theme song for the Super Mario Brothers game.
One day I took a ride to see a friend. To my surprise, the man was a kid again. He ran back to the television, took a seat. Big change, cause he used to love her on the streets. I closed the door, made myself at home. He was acting as if he was in a twilight zone. I won't say no names, though he showed no shame. He jetted back to the world of the video game. So there he sat with his eyes crisscrossed, pushing buttons, looking like he's in the land of the lost. I tried to get his attention, so I stepped in the way. He's a shine you wanna get, boom, bash today. I backed up, took a look to see what was so fascinating. After a while, I too was participating. Not because of my friend's harsh words, but because of the death melody I heard. Hit it!
One thing I really like about Shinehead is his light touch. Unlike so much reggae, in which the beat thuds relentlessly, Shinehead often makes music that's airy and delicate. On this cut, Dance Down the Road, the high voice he uses reminds me a little of Boy George at his best.
It's quite a while now, I've been home. I got a restless cowboy feeling again, so it's time to roam. Music and people, yeah, that's what I need. And if you didn't know, here's where all roads lead to the dance down the road. Let's go to the dance down the road.
So far, dancehall reggae is most popular in England. Here in America, various cuts by Shinehead and Frighty and Colonel Mite pop up in dance clubs and on a few of the more adventurous radio stations. It's a style that deserves to be more widely heard. I think it could easily be the stuff that makes reggae a mass pop phenomenon in America, for the first time in the music's history.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Let's keep dancing with more Shinehead.
They say good things don't last too long, but thanks to you, we've proved them wrong. They say good things don't last too long, but thanks to you, we've proved them wrong.
This is Fresh Air. Over the years, filmmaker Christian Blackwood logged thousands of miles on the road and stayed in hundreds of motels while working on documentary films. He enjoyed the people he met there so much that he later decided to make a documentary about them. Motel is that film, where we meet an aging ballerina who owns a rundown motel in a ghost town in the Southwest, and a group of women at the Blue Mist Motel who wait to visit their husbands held at the Arizona State Prison across the road. The film airs later this month on the public television series POV. Christian Blackwood's made over 40 films, including Memoirs of a Movie Palace about Lowe's King's Theater in New York, work on the acclaimed Straight No Chaser, Thelonious Monk, and Observations Under the Volcano about the making of John Huston's Under the Volcano. He's been making films for over 20 years, but Blackwood says he never intended to be a filmmaker.
I went to Europe on a vacation, and like so many young tourists, ran out of money and landed in Germany and needed a job. And so I went to the television station at the time, and it was very small, and I asked them for a job, and they said, well, what can you do? And I said, well, I can't really do anything. How about acting? And they said, well, they don't need actors, but why don't you go into the camera department? So I went into the camera department, and some young camera assistant was being fired as I walked in, and I was hired at that very moment. But they knew that I was not familiar with cameras, so they said, it doesn't matter, we'll teach you. And within 2 weeks, I learned how to use a camera, and I became the assistant to a very good cinematographer, and I quickly continued by making my own films about a half year after my... tenure with this cameraman.
So it was really kind of serendipity that you that led you into filmmaking.
Absolutely. I actually studied acting and directing because I wanted to be a theater director. That was my sort of purpose in life at the time. But film was sort of up and coming, and I took advantage of it. And I was actually very fortunate. And I spent 4 years in Europe and Africa making documentaries, feature films, shorts, in 35mm and 16mm.
Many of your films have been shown at film festivals and on television,
mm-hmm.
But not in movie houses, not in general release. Is this something that bothers you? Do you mind that? Would you like to have a large screen release?
Some of them have been shown in movie theaters, but it's very hard to get documentaries on the silver screen. I've been fighting that for years, and I'm slowly giving up now because it's just too much trouble, and so I'm going into feature films as soon as I get out of the studio here.
What attracts you about doing a feature film?
Basically, what attracts me is what attracted me to the documentary, to deal with people. I don't make the traditional documentary with commentary over, you know, pictures. I deal with people. I deal with their emotions, their happiness, their woes, their whatever the situation is. And that's what I think feature films are about, to deal with actors who are also just people. And I think the documentary is similar. Feature film people think they're documentarians. They, you know, they put a tripod, they put a camera on a tripod, and then just turn on the camera and hope for the best. Well, that's not quite how most of us work. We deal with that subject very intensely. We give them our personality so that they can give their personality back to us. And so now I think it's time to deal with similar subject matter, but creating more the storyline. Like Motel, for me, is almost like, I call it a featurementary, not a documentary, because I was creating the story as I was making it. I was writing the screenplay, so to speak, while I was making it.
How did your idea for the documentary Motel change from the time you first thought about doing it to the time that you finished editing it?
They didn't change simply because I didn't begin to write the script until I was actually doing it. I knew from the start that I had spent years living in motels while I was making other films. And those years, I remember meeting the most amusing and glorious people. And I thought to myself, actually, this would, you know, one day I would like to spend a month vacation making a film. That's basically what I did. And I drove 5,000 miles looking for two, three, or four, or five ideal motels where people were interesting enough for me to spend time with them.
The people that you focused on in the film, either those who stayed as guests in the motels or who ran them, use motels as a refuge, a hiding out place. And how did they react to a filmmaker coming in and nosing around with a camera?
Well, they were startled, to say the least. But the way I work is, I mean, they get to know me, and they begin to trust me, and they begin to get curious why I would want to make a film. And slowly but surely, I think they realize that it's not the motel that I'm really interested in, it's them that I'm interested in. And I'm just using the motel as an excuse to be able to talk to them. And that's what really my film is about. It's about people.
How much time would you spend with the people before they became comfortable?
Actually, very short. I mean, most of them I only spent a day or two with, or three, a maximum. Perhaps I was waiting for a certain thing to happen, but not more than two, three days. And we generally got along terribly well very quickly.
A number of your films have been documentaries about singers, musicians, Charles mm-hmm. Aznavour, Eartha Kitt, Thelonious Monk. Mm-hmm. What is it about musicians that drew you as a filmmaker? I mean, they're
because I'm so unmusical. The musicians fascinate me. I mean, I can't read a note. I don't understand how people can read notes. You know, it's like someone from another planet for me. It's fascinating. And so I made these films. Also, these are characters that interested me as people. Eartha Kitt, I think, is a fascinating woman. I just, you know, as a child, I remember Eartha Kitt, seeing her on Broadway, and I thought how wonderful she was. And then later on in life, I saw her once in a cabaret, and I thought, my God, she's still as wonderful as I remember her as a kid. So I said, well, I must do something about that. So I did. And unfortunately, that film has never been shown in this country, but fortunately now will be next year, also on public broadcasting and the Learning Channel. The film was shown, and we were talking about theatrical releases, it showed for 40 weeks in Paris, in Germany, in England, in Scandinavia, and only 2 weeks at a New York theater. And which, for me, was always very shocking.
You've made some documentaries about the making of films and the making of plays. Is it a distracting presence to be on the set for the motion picture coverage while you're making a documentary? How do you try to work around with two different kits of equipment there?
I can't really say that, whether it is distracting. I hope not. I work with only one other person. I have I'm a director, a cinematographer, so I have a sound person with me, and he or she, we stay very closely together, and we gel with the rest of the crew. And we've never been thrown off a set, let's put it that way. Sometimes, the making of Death of a Salesman with Dustin Hoffman, and Arthur Miller was there, which was extraordinary to have Arthur Miller, the playwright, finally on the same set as Dustin Hoffman, and both were producers. And there, it was called Private Conversations, and that's exactly what the film is about. It's about the translation from stage to screen, an adaptation of his wonderful play. And there, I was very curious how they were going to do that. So I picked up all the sort of private conversations, the struggle, of how this would work on film.
Do you think it's important as a documentary filmmaker to be able to disappear in the present, even though there's a camera and a microphone around?
When I make a film, I become part of the situation. I always have my camera on my shoulder, so after a while, if I don't have my camera on the shoulder, people will sort of look at me strangely or won't recognize me, because they recognize me only as a person who has a camera on their shoulder. And I think that's the only way you can really make a document. I mean, that's what, for me, a documentary is all about, is either creating something or observing something, and as I said before, writing that screenplay as you are listening to it.
Christian Blackwood, thank you very much for coming and talking with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you very much.
Christian Blackwood's documentary, Motel, airs on public television series POV later this month. This is Fresh Air. Later today here on National Public Radio, today's edition of All Things Considered. Noah Adams, the host of the show, has come down to tell us what's ahead today. Hello, Noah.
Hi, Serge. In Kuwait, Iraq is ordering that Americans and Britons be assembled in hotels in Kuwait City, thousands of them. We'll have the State Department and the White House response to that action. The Pentagon says today that there are plans to deploy 45,000 Marines additionally in the Persian Gulf. The King of Jordan, King Hussein, has left Maine after a meeting with President Bush. He was talking for more than 2 hours. He said he didn't really have a message for the president from Iraq's Saddam Hussein. Also, we'll talk with Peter Rowan, a new album of songs about the Dust Bowl.
Thanks, Noah. That's all later today on All Things Considered here on National Public Radio. More people now know who David Lynch is from the successful TV show he co-created, Twin Peaks. Before TV, Lynch made movies, Eraserhead, Dune, and Blue Velvet. His new film, Wild at Heart, stars Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern. It won the Palme d'Or at this year's Cannes Film Festival and opens in theaters around the country this weekend. Critic Owen Gleiberman has this review.
Baby, I got a surprise for you.
Hey, my snakeskin jacket! Thanks, baby! Did I ever tell you that this here jacket represents a symbol of my individuality and my belief in personal freedom?
About 50,000 times. I got us a room at the Cape Fear. And guess what? Power Man's playing at the Hurricane.
Stabbing and steer.
That was Nicolas Cage trying to sound like Elvis Presley. As Wild at Heart goes on, he keeps talking like Elvis, and he keeps repeating that line about his snakeskin jacket. I think it's supposed to be a joke, though the whole movie is so self-conscious, it's a little hard to tell. This is the first time I've watched a David Lynch film and felt that he was showing off. From the joltingly violent opening sequence, in which Cage smashes a guy's brains out against a marble floor, you can feel Lynch working overtime to shock you. Wild at Heart is a scabrous and bloody Southern Gothic road comedy, and almost nothing in it feels very spontaneous. Even Twin Peaks, which was made within the restrictions of network television, had far more of Lynch's true spirit. Cage plays Sailor Ripley, a tough stud delinquent just released from prison. Laura Dern is his hot and bothered girlfriend, Lula, whom he calls Peanut. These two are crazy about each other, but Lula's mom, who has the hots for Sailor, is determined to keep them apart. As they head out of town, they're pursued by a private detective and then a mobster. But Lula and Sailor have each other, and to them, that's all that matters.
Peanut, I'm thinking of breaking parole and taking you out to Santa California.
Sailor!
You up for that?
I'd go the far end of the world for you, baby. I would.
Rockin' good news.
As Wild at Heart goes on, Lynch captures the druggy obsessiveness of a young love affair, the feeling of being happily drowned in erotic pleasure. Laura Dern is an actress who puts nothing between her emotions and the audience. She plays Lula as a spunky daredevil in black leather bras. At the same time, no one in contemporary movies can say the words "I love you" with such feverish yearning. For the most part, though, these two characters are way too thin. The idea behind Sailor seems to be that if you take an Elvis-worshipping delinquent, a guy who's an utter cliché, and then exaggerate him to the nth power, you'll have a wild and crazy David Lynch hero. But with a high-stepping put-on artist like Cage at the center of the movie, Lynch can't establish his usual duality between weirdness and innocence. Wild at Heart lacks the primal pleasures of Lynch's best work. Lynch fills the movie with scattered bits of subversive humor, a belabored series of references to The Wizard of Oz, and cameos by actors like Crispin Glover and John Lurie, who carry their hip credentials onto the screen with them. It's not until late in the film that Willem Dafoe makes his appearance as Bobby Peru, the most evil of Sailor and Lula's tormentors. Outfitted with fake gums and a pencil mustache, Dafoe proves a master of leering villainy. The scene in which he terrorizes Lula in her motel room has a teasing power. Slowly, Lula's fear and revulsion melt into ambiguous desire. As that happens, we sink into the dark side along with her. But that's the only moment when Wild at Heart attains that quintessentially Lynch-like quality, the rapturous and terrifying sensation of being lost in dreams.
Owen Gleiberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air is produced this week by Fred Landerall. Our engineers are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, and Thad Kirk. Chris, stand by. Spurgeon directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we take a meeting with Alan Pakula. He directed Clute, All the President's Men, in the new movie Presumed Innocent. Also writer Tony Hiss on the relationship between people and their surroundings. That and more next time on Fresh Air.